Welcome to a very special edition of Enclave On Air. I'm your host today, Gina Columbus. Enclave On Air is a podcast from Enclave, which provides oncology professionals with the resources and information they need to provide the best patient care. In both digital and print formats, Enclave covers every angle of oncology practice, from new technology to treatment advances to important regulatory decisions. But today, we had the pleasure of sitting down with Maha Hussain, MD, FACP, FASCO, Genevieve Tooten Professor of Medicine in the Division of Hematology Oncology in the Department of Medicine, and the Deputy Director at the Robert H. Lurie Comprehensive Cancer Center of the Northwestern University Feinberg School of Medicine. Dr. Hussain has been a leading oncologist in the genitourinary cancer field and is focused on the development of novel therapeutics integrating scientific advances into clinical trials in prostate and bladder cancer. Thus far, she has had an impressive career in oncology, including her contribution to research that led to the FDA approval of docetaxel for the treatment of men with advanced prostate cancer. As a lead investigator in an international collaborative trial, she also evaluated optimal schedules of androgen deprivation therapy for patients with newly diagnosed metastatic prostate cancer. Enclave recognized Dr. Hussain as a giant of cancer care in genitourinary cancers in 2015. In our exclusive interview, Dr. Hussain reflected on the path that led her into GU cancers, pivotal research she has been a part of, and strategies in the pipeline she's intrigued by, and the challenges she has overcome in her career while offering advice to young oncologists just getting started in the field. Hi, Dr. Hussain. We're so happy to have you here for this episode of Enclave On Air. Could you first discuss some background to your career and exactly what is it that led you into the field of genitourinary cancers?
I trained in medicine in the early 1980s, and these were very exciting and challenging times. We were beginning to see many, many more cancer patients being admitted, and there were some interesting and very exciting progress, like chemotherapy for testis cancer, the hormonal therapy for breast cancer, and so on. And yet, there were still huge amount of gaps in these cancers and other cancers. My fascination, actually, with GU oncology specifically occurred during, again, the same time my residency and medical oncology fellowship, when, began interacting with men with prostate cancer, men and women with bladder and kidney cancer, younger men with testis cancer. And it just seemed like there was such a, again, an exciting field from the perspective of opportunity to impact outcomes for patients, discovery, research, and then help patients across the spectrum of age and gender and race and so on.
Great. Thank you. I was reading an earlier article that we had written on you when you were given the Giants of Cancer Care Award in 2015. And I remembered that you spoke a little bit about your time in Iraq. You obviously had a change of plans that ended up not being able to practice over there. And you eventually obviously came to the United States to practice. Could you talk a little bit about that experience?
Sure, absolutely. So in the Middle East, and I'm going to speak specifically about our family, the goals were to definitely train, subspecialize, and then go back home to practice. And I left 1980, which was around the time a few weeks before after I got married, and actually a few weeks before I was due to start my training in the university hospital in Baghdad for the opportunity to train in England and then hopefully head back home. And then, of course, those of you and your listeners will know, were very dramatic times in the Middle East, specifically in Iraq, because the Iraq-Iran war started. And then over the last 30 years, practically, there's been one dramatic situation followed by another dramatic situation. And so I have not been able to go back. As it turns out, this probably was one of the best things that happened to us, not just myself, but my family. I would say it's like anything else. Sometimes you think it's the end of the road, but in reality, it's more of an opportunity. I came to Michigan, and that was driven by the fact that I had an uncle who was a medical oncologist, academic oncologist in the area. And I started my training at Wayne State, which was really an amazing times in terms of education, learning, research, everything, and worked in the Ellen Park VA, which is one of the oldest VAs in the country, that gave me the opportunity to interact with veterans, and obviously prostate cancer was a major disease that they had.
Wow, thank you for sharing that. Going into some of the research that you've been involved in, you've obviously had a lot of research in prostate cancer as well as bladder cancer, kidney cancer. Is there some research that you would like to kind of really speak to that's had significant impacts on clinical practice? What was it really like to be part of that?
Well, as I said, I entered the field in very exciting times where there were a fair amount of federal, institutional, and pharmaceutical investment in development of treatments for GU malignancies. I have been fortunate enough to be part of large teams, including the cooperative groups like SWOG. I was part of the genitourinary committee and was the chair for the Advanced Prostate Cancer Subcommittee. And so we had really great opportunities to have some impact, I think, in the field as you know, as a team. I do take pride in being part of the team or have been the lead on certain initiatives that led to perhaps shaping up or contributing to standards of care, beginning with, for example, Taxotere in metastatic castration-resistant prostate cancer, being part of the team that identified the role of Taxotere in metastatic hormone-sensitive prostate cancer. This is the work that was done by the cooperative groups and the clinical trial that led to that. I've also have had the opportunity to work with the team to identify agents' role in non-metastatic castration-resistant disease, the role of scheduling of hormonal treatment in terms of intermittent versus continuous treatment in the context of hormone-sensitive disease, was part of the prostate cancer stand-up to cancer dream team. And sort of as a result of some of the collaborations there, we've developed, clinical trials that were one of the first, I would say, biomarker-based type trials. And obviously now at the international level, I am involved with multiple clinical trials that are evaluating really critical questions, including the role of PARP inhibition in the treatment of prostate cancer. So it's been very exciting, and as I said, it takes a team to develop this kind of work. And to me, there are no borders. As they say, the world is flat, and the ultimate goal is conquering cancer.
That's wonderful, and I'm really glad towards the end you brought up the PARP inhibitor studies. Can you speak a little bit more to that and how we're kind of making, not just in prostate cancer, but we're really finding these kind of genetic markers across tumor types and how an agent such as these PARP inhibitors are showing a benefit. They've seen it in obviously in ovarian cancer, breast cancer, and now we're seeing it in prostate cancer. Can you speak to kind of the activity that we've been seeing so far?
Certainly. I think we have seen several positive signals with regard to the role of PARP inhibitors in prostate cancer. These signals are driven by at least a couple of clinical trials, TOPARP A and B. The work that I have done, which is a little different in that we're combining the PARP inhibitor with androgen receptor pathway inhibitors like abiraterone, I think what's clear is this, is there is a strong signal. The signal has to be validated, and there are currently at least, I believe, three randomized clinical trials, including a trial I'm involved in. And so I think that it's going to be very exciting times to see what the results are, because one of them is the critical part is the fact that up until now in prostate cancer, none of the trials that we have done thus far, up until, like, again, looking at the PARP story, anything before that has not been involving any molecular biomarkers. factors in terms of pre-selecting the patients or stratifying the patients based on a genomics. And so this is really opening up the door to show that, in fact, it is possible to do that in prostate cancer. And, of course, there are multiple potentially interesting pathways that are worth investing in prostate cancer, coming from the work from different institutions internationally, but also from the Stand Up to Cancer dream teams. So I think there is really exciting times, and I think the potential to have a biomarker-driven type treatment for prostate cancer is not too far from us, I hope.
I want to go into a little bit of the relationship that you've had with your patients. Is there any kind of one or two patients in particular that have really almost completely changed your practice, or they've just had a very lasting impact on you?
There was one gentleman who was my patient when I was in Michigan, and he was a younger gentleman with prostate cancer. And he had presented with really aggressive disease. And as I finished my consultation with him, he looked at me and he said, "Why me?" And that was really pretty, I mean, I was tearful. In fact, I'm tearing right now, just remembering that. And this really prompted me to start, and this was, he was not the only patient that I have seen with this kind of aggressive bad disease just out of the blues, basically. And so that really prompted me to submit an application to the Prostate Cancer Foundation to try to look into the mystery, I would call it, of why some patients are developing prostate cancer at a younger age with a very aggressive profile. This gentleman is now deceased, and I have a lot of memorabilia from my patients that I have in my office, actually, and a good number of those memorabilia are from men who have had a very aggressive cancer, and within a very short period of time, they are deceased. So this is always in my mind. There. I also remember that, all the time is like we are here to help patients, and it's a very tough situation they're going through. And there are a lot of patients who are also very grateful for, the time they have gotten to be with their families, to kind of live their dreams and things like that. So one of them is actually an elderly gentleman who loved to take photography, and he used to be a professor. And I actually have one of his pictures, photos in my office, which reminds me of him, because he wanted to go live his life. He wanted to do what he had always wanted to do, is go on an adventurous trips and just do photography. So, it's a wonderful experience as physicians we have to interact with different patients who have different views on life, who have different objectives, who have different priorities. And things like that. And I have to say that this interaction sort of feeds into what I want to do in terms of helping patients moving forward.
Kind of going off of that, are there certain mottos or mantras that you tell yourself kind of day to day as you're going through your clinic?
The one thing I always think about, that whatever happens, could be me, could be my family, could be my brother, could be my, cousin, it could be any one of us. And so every day I would say, what I tell my patients actually, live like there is no tomorrow, but hope for lots of tomorrows. And at the same time, try to actually change life. And as I tell my patients, we're all guaranteed to die. That's a fact. And so the critical part is to try to maximize the quality of life and definitely push hard on the research front to try to maximize quantity of life.
How about specific challenges that you may have faced in your career? Are there any kind of hurdles that you had to work to overcome?
Nothing unique that I would not consider as part of life. I don't know if that, again, makes sense or not, but there is nothing easy in life that's straightforward, right? So you go through your life hoping to live every day to the maximum and accomplish everything you have wanted to do through your career at both the person, at the professional level, obviously, and then at the personal level to also live your life. And so like anything else, day in, day out, there are different challenges that we deal with. I mean, not everybody like me is an immigrant, for example, who've trained somewhere else. You kind of have to prove yourself. You have to go through additional testing and evaluation. You have to adjust to life. You know what I'm saying? So there's all these parts of life. But I would say if I could do it, others can. I think, as I tell people, if you have a fire in your belly, you could accomplish anything you want to.
I like that. I like that a lot.
I will tell you this, what I tell the ladies in the field, which is something I always say. I say sleep is overrated. If you have passion about something, do it. And but the most important thing is balancing personal and professional life. And you can decide for yourself what is your priority. But in my case, for example, one of the challenges is balancing both and parallel tracking them both. I wanted to be a mother, and I didn't want to have to wait until I am done with my training to become a mother. And things of that sort. So you have to just figure out how you run your life. And if I could do it again, I think others can do it if that's their, that's their parallel priorities.
I'm so glad you brought that up, because my next question actually was, what advice can you give to women who are also interested in specializing in genitourinary cancers and especially prostate cancer, which, we've all heard, it's working in a man's world. And as a obviously very successful female oncologist, I'd love to hear what kind of advice you can also give to fellow women.
You know, I would say my first advice, do not think of yourself, whether, I have mentees who are men, and I have mentees who are over the years who have been women. Don't think of yourself as a man or a woman. Think of yourself as a human being. We're dealing with illnesses. They can happen to anybody. And as a human being, you need to do what's right, and you need to also live up to what your dreams are and expectations are. And like anything else, you have to compete and you have to hustle. Nothing is a freebie. And if you're passionate about something, go after it. At the same time, decide what your priorities are. And I always tell my trainees, again, irrespective of gender, from my end, family comes first, but my passion was also important. And so it's like what I would call 60-40 type thing, 60%, 40%. But then to try to achieve that sort of time commitment and everything else, I've kind of taken time to make sure that, I have my own space, my own time, so that I can address these things, address the issues, the ideas, the different things that I'm passionate about. And as I said, I think it's doable. Ultimately, you decide what your priorities are. And nothing comes free. And you sort of have to decide what is it that you are interested in accomplishing and such and work on it. And there is a piece of luck, I have to say. I mean, I've been fortunate in that every time I have dreamt of something and wanted to do it, working hard, ultimately it happened. Did I get everything I wanted to do? Not necessarily. But did I accomplish most of what I wanted to do? The answer is yes.
Looking at the road ahead in genitourinary cancers, are there other areas of research that have you very excited that's going on in the pipeline, or areas that you think need to be focused on more that we aren't currently really honing in on?
One of the most critical areas, and this is something that I have been very much passionate about and did research in, is really advancing effective treatments into earlier stages of the disease. And I am very much confident that such kind of investment in research is worth it. We have several examples. If you look at end-stage disease, and by the way, prostate is no different, or GU cancers are no different than other cancers. And what we have across the board, that investment in clinical trials, moving promising treatments or interventions from advanced stage gradually into the higher risk earlier stage, gives a better return on investment. And so I think this is an area where I would love for us to see work happening. We invested in through the national cooperative groups with SWOG on a clinical trial that I think I designed in the late 1990s, looking at high-risk prostate cancer patients who have had surgery, but they have high-risk disease, to consider treatment with adjuvant treatment. Now, we were able to do it, and this is the beauty of the federal funding, in that it does allow you to do trials that can go almost 20 years before you can get outcomes. And ultimately, I think the goal would be is gradually moving in very personalized strategies of care to men with higher risk disease, whether it's at time of diagnosis or early relapse, to try to kind of give them better impact. I think the other part that I think is critical is the issue of survivorship. A lot of patients are with prostate cancer, for example, and certainly nowadays with bladder cancer, kidney cancer, are likely to live longer with different treatments that we have. And so trying to maximize quality of life is important. And then I think areas of working in terms of cost effectiveness and reducing the financial toxicity on patients is very important. So I think there are several things that are very critical and I think are doable. At the end of the day, a lot of what I'm working on is really developing newer treatments for the deadly phase of the disease, which is the metastatic disease. And I think my goal, and again, I don't think this is just a personal goal of mine, but others, is to transform it into more of a chronic disease with the hope that we can get better sort of mileage from different treatments that will allow men to live much longer and not necessarily die from prostate cancer.
You are a 2015 recipient in GU Cancers, and congratulations. And
thank you.
What does this type of recognition mean to you, especially one that in which you've been nominated by your peers for?
You know, it honestly is an honor. We go in, day out, where you're busy with your everyday life and you're not thinking about things. And, you know, like you think, you know, what have I done lately? Have I really contributed to something? And to have my peers recognize that whatever I have done has led to an impact as small as or as big as it might be, you know, depending on how you look at it, is really an ultimate honor and reaffirmation that the path I have taken is a worthy path.
Thank you so much, Dr. Hussain. Is there anything else about your career or any other research that you're involved in currently that you'd like to highlight that I didn't ask you about?
I do think that we live in very exciting times. I do think that we are seeing a lot of progress in the field across the spectrum of the diseases. And as far as I'm concerned, research is what will cure cancer. And so the sky is the limit.
Great.
On what we can do.
That's all we have time for today. Thank you for listening to this special episode of Enclave On Air. Check back on Wednesdays for new interviews with top KOLs in the oncology field. For more updates on oncology care, be sure to visit www.enclave.com and sign up for our e-newsletters. Enclave is also on social media. On Twitter, follow us at Enclave and at Enclave SOSS. On Facebook, like us at Enclave and Enclave State of the Science Summit, and follow our Enclave page on LinkedIn. If you liked today's episode of Enclave On Air, please consider subscribing to our podcast on Apple Podcasts so you get a notification every time a new episode is posted. While you are there, please take a moment to rate us. Thanks again for listening to Enclave On Air.